company of forward thinkers with more than 55,000 employees around the globe and products in 58 customer countries, Raytheon has established itself as a trusted partner. From detection to action, we give our customers a decisive advantage. Customer-driven, technology-powered. Raytheon, revolutionizing defense capabilities.
Hello, and welcome to the Emerging Technology Horizons podcast. I'm Arun Serafin, Executive Director of NDIA's Emerging Technologies Institute. Today, we're going to talk about one of the key challenges facing any emerging technology or innovator trying to work within the defense space with the Pentagon, with defense industry. And that's the difficulties of pushing things uphill through a bureaucracy. Maybe a very successful bureaucracy, a very sure of itself bureaucracy, but nonetheless a bureaucracy. And lucky for us today, we have an expert on strategies and best practices for navigating and making impact in large bureaucracies. I'm joined today by Nick Sinai, who makes a large impact in everything he tries. He's a senior advisor at Insight Partners, which is a global private equity and venture capital firm. He's also an adjunct faculty member at Harvard University's Kennedy School, senior fellow at their Belfer Center's Technology and Public Purpose Project. He's previously served as the U.S. Deputy Chief Technology Officer at the White House. I had the honor of working around and with him when I did some time at OSTP in the White House. He's also the co-author of this book, Hack Your Bureaucracy. Get things done no matter what your role on any team. There's Nick's version. It's a book on transforming ideas into impact regardless of your role in industry, the role on your team, and I would say the role in either the public or private sector. Beyond that, Nick's got many, many notable accomplishments, including little things like co-founding the U.S. Digital Corps, which is a two-year federal fellowship for early career technologists. When he was at the White House, he led President Obama's open data initiatives. He co-led the Open Government Initiative, and he helped start the Presidential Innovation Fellow Program. He also played a key role in crafting the National Broadband Plan at the FCC. Thank you, Nick, for joining us today, and thank you for talking about this important topic for anyone who cares about making sure that the Pentagon is as innovative as possible and adopt as many good emerging technologies and services as possible. I want to start just by, I tried to do your bio some justice, but you know, with that wide set of experiences, you know, what brings you, you could focus on anything you want. What brings you to focus on thinking about bureaucracies?
Yeah, it's so much fun to be here with you, Arun, and who would have thought back in our days of, you know, middle management inside a lesser policy council inside the presidency that we'd be here today doing this podcast. The book really came out of a collaboration and a friendship. So my good friend, Marina Nitsa, she was Marina Martin back then, this is her married name. She was in the first round of the Presidential Innovation Fellows. And then she came to the White House and worked with me for a little bit. And the VA, as you might remember, was going through a challenging time on the front page of the New York Times. The Daily Show was hammering it for the backlog and the claims crisis. And ultimately, Secretary Shinseki lost his job. But one of the things that Marina did was help audit the VA and identify some ways for them to improve. And she so impressed all the colleagues in the White House that we ended up installing her at the VA, the largest bureaucracy, at least in the federal civilian space. It's maybe small by DOD standards, but you know, it's 400,000 people. It's not that small. And she helped change the VA despite having no budget, no people. She was 28-year-old SES, I think the youngest SES in history, at least that I can find. And you know, we've stayed friends and collaborated, and we were always kind of curious and have batted around. You know, why are some people really successful inside large organizations, and especially government organizations, but not exclusively? And why do some people kind of flame out? And so we started to write down some of our experiences. So there's a few stories of mine and several of hers as well as some of my good failures as well. And then over time, we started to include friends and other people who we admired. And we basically put it together in a book of over 50 tactics on, you know, how to make change at scale. And it's really not rocket science. We just tried to put some really fun stories to it from across the federal bureaucracy. But we also have stories at large tech companies like Amazon. We have, you know, stories about, you know, your homeowners association. And really the premise is that if you're going to make change in any organization, you really have to understand the beast. So you have to know the processes, how people think about risk, but ultimately you have to know people. And then you have to make progress. That is, start small, prototype, gain some momentum, which gets you more people or resources. You know, build a team, both informal and formal team over time, and then make those changes stick, right? How do you institutionalize? So it's very much a book of how do you empower people to make change regardless of what level they are, wherever they sit in an organization. Too often we have this idea of top-down change, right? The commander-in-chief, the secretary, whoever is going to kind of come at you with some big transformation or innovation idea. But so much of the great innovation we've seen in the public and private sector and DoD is when there's an enterprising person or series of people that get an idea, and yes, they're able to attract air cover, they're able to attract permissions or waivers and kind of build some real momentum. And so we hope this book is inspiring to everyone, whether they are trying to hack a bureaucracy from, you know, outside of the Pentagon, like many of your members, or whether they're inside of the Defense Department and trying to make it easier to not only try, but scale emerging technologies.
So when you think about the book and the title of the book, Hack Your Bureaucracy, and it's incredibly well laid out and it's really digestible for experts and non-experts. I'm assuming people use it as a management textbook as well somewhere. You do set up bureaucracy as a little bit of a villain, not completely. And I want you to sort of rehabilitate the idea of bureaucracy in and of itself a little bit, if there is anything that is to be commendable about a bureaucracy.
Yeah, I think we're actually pretty gentle on bureaucracies, and we went back and read some scholars of bureaucracy. There's actually such a thing, and you know, look, there's lots of organizational behavior, academic writing, and so forth. And, you know, at the end of the day, most organizations either are a bureaucracy or show some bureaucratic tendencies. Because, you know, what is a bureaucracy? It's fundamentally some level of hierarchy, some level of standardized process, right? And some level of expertise. So I guess the antithesis is really a one-person business or an organization where all the decisions are made completely capriciously. But anytime you get to any kind of scale, public or private sector, you know, you're going to have a repeatable process. You're going to have some level of hierarchy. You're going to have some specialized expertise. And so Marina and I really see this as a neutral term. And we do a lot of book talks with both startups and large companies who talk about, you know, how to avoid being a bureaucracy or how to be a better bureaucracy. And we don't think you can avoid, whether you are a small or a large company, becoming a bureaucracy. Question is, can you become an adaptive one that is learning? Because ultimately, the customer or the warfighter in DoD's cases, the customer needs change and the needs of employees change because, you know, look, the world is changing and technology is changing. And so, you know, all the processes, all of the ways that things happen, whether it is the way you budget and resource, the way you hire, the way you promote, all of these processes were made by humans. Like, this is nowhere was this, you know, written on some stone tablets somewhere. And even then, you know, it probably was a human being writing those on tablets. But right. I don't want get into religious debates. And the point is, these are human organizations that can be changed.
I'll just to jump in here. I was one of those people who used to write things that people thought were written on stone tablets, the law. We used to call the law a shared word processing document. And it was just sort of people trying to write those rules, but you never could quite anticipate how it would be read or accepted or held up or honestly sometimes ignored by the organizations, right?
Are you saying that DOD sometimes slow walks or ignores laws? I thought that was just policy from the presidency, and I was glad to know that it's a shared experience.
It's entirely possible, and that gets it at some of the things you point out about the, you know, what drives risk aversion sometimes in these bureaucracies is the fear of what happens to you if you don't follow what you think is written into a stone tablet, right? Or is written into the law. I would say, though, from other perspectives, I've often said, I've never successfully called Arlington County Police to have anyone in the Pentagon arrested for not following something that was in the National Defense Authorization Act. And so, there's different ways of looking at this issue. So you show up in Washington after a successful career and decide to try your hand at public service, which is great. What was your first impression then of working with a large bureaucracy, maybe like DOD?
I was totally naive, Arun. So it started when I was on my honeymoon in Italy. The very first day I opened the newspaper, it says Lehman Brothers goes bust. The only problem is I just joined Lehman Brothers Venture Partners, the venture capital arm of Lehman Brothers. And I told my wife at the time, no problem, let's enjoy the honeymoon. And when we get back, because we lived in the Boston area, I was going to start networking for a job in DC because I wanted to get a job in President Obama's administration. And I didn't realize how naive that was and how naive that sounds as an early 30-something, you know, post-MBA venture capitalist who, you know, been a VC for 4 or 5 years and was just going to move down to DC. And, you know, we didn't have a mortgage or kids. And so it was a little bit easier. But this idea of like, I'm just going to go get a job in the Obama administration. And not realizing that there's, you know, all of professional DC and the Democratic establishment and, you know, 10,000 paid volunteers and all these other people who also had ideas about getting a job. I managed to talk my way into the FCC as part of the National Broadband Plan, because I did have some background and expertise in telecommunications and also some experience in clean energy investing. And so kind of the merger of the two was exactly what they were looking for. And I really enjoyed starting at one of these blue ribbon task force, because I think it's a great place of high intensity and a chance to learn policymaking with relatively low consequences. That is, blue ribbon task force can say anything and, you know, Congress and the administration can accept or ignore those kinds of things. So it was a great training ground for me. And then I spent 4 years in the Office of Science and Technology Policy and you know, got exposure to the larger federal bureaucracy. And to me, I did a lot of interagency stuff. And that was just fascinating because you could see all kinds of behaviors of agencies that would lean in and see you as their champion and try and get you to highlight their thing or codify their thing. And then there are other times and other agencies, I won't point the fingers at DOD, but there were times when they would send someone to the meeting who was very explicit that he was responsible for slow walking a particular policy. So I've seen all kinds. You know, in the Defense Department, we tell the story, just to bring it back to the book, of Enrique Oddi, who's this really smart, fast-talking colonel who had, I think he was an intel and cyber officer, had a China expert, had spent time out at Stanford, and was really frustrated. The Air Force was talking about 2030 and this vision of the Air Force. And as someone who's spending time in Silicon Valley, he could just see, you know, that what they were talking about 15 years in the future was the way things were today in Silicon Valley. And in fact, my first introduction to Enrique was at General Bender's retirement ceremony. So I had gotten to know the CIO of the Air Force a little bit as a venture capitalist after I'd left the White House. And this was really eye-opening for me, is because this is one of these retirement ceremonies where, you know, it's an Andrews, there's the chief of staff, there's, you know, several bands and receiving line and all the great traditions, right? You know, and family-friendly traditions. But these are big events when a three-star retires. And I don't think I had appreciated all the military customs. But anyway, so I tell the story in the book. We tell the story in the book of Enrique not only working the crowd to beg permission or forgiveness during that event, but ultimately of starting small, you know, recruiting a couple airmen to code and showing that they can build software in a faster and better way. And that ultimately became Kessel Run, right? And so it takes that kind of entrepreneur. And that's what I'm always on the lookout for. When I was in public service, I was always looking for entrepreneurially minded folks. I think that's why I got involved in a lot of things like the Presidential Innovation Fellows, like the Open Data Program, like all those kinds of things where you saw people who were looking for the seams and trying to build a little bit of momentum. And it's why, you know, post-government service, I've returned to venture capital to work with entrepreneurs. And more recently now, I'm on the board of four defense or dual-use companies. So Hawkeye 360, Leo Lab, Shift5, and Rebellion Defense. And working with entrepreneurs who are determined to bring important commercial capabilities into the national security space, which is, as you know, not that easy.
Yeah. So, you're pointing out again that those of us and those companies that you mentioned that are trying to bring in these new kinds of services, these new kinds of technologies, are facing a lot of tradition, a lot of culture, a lot of process that exists arguably for good reason. I guess I'm curious, right? You do use the word hacking, let alone the fact that hacking is associated often with threat. That's not the point there, but hacking sort of does imply a shortcut. And are you setting people up for a little bit of failure, implying that there are shortcuts? It's more like, you know, friends of ours, folks like our good friend Tom Khalil, he uses a phrase sometimes, water over stone, as a different way of sort of reducing resistance.
Yeah.
Do you think it's more water over stone? Do you think it's more like outlast your bureaucracy?
Yeah, you know, and in fact, I quote Tom Khalil heavily and talk about him in the opening of the book, because he is definitely an inspiration. I do believe that there is an element of time, and we talk about this in the book, of continue to chip away and to show progress, and that there's an element of luck and timing to that. And so being prepared and making progress, sometimes you'll have those non-linear gains in whatever you're trying to do. You know, back to the word hack, hack is one of those words that means a lot of different things these days. Like, I mean, it also means like a crappy journalist, for example, right? You can get called a hack. But in, you know, one way that the word hack is used is a clever fix. And so it is in that idea of a clever fix. I'm not saying an unauthorized thing, but sometimes there's a, you know, you can have with permission do something in 2 weeks, and with permission, you can do something in 2 years. And so the we're not suggesting that people break the rules. In fact, a lot of the book is trying the normal way first and understanding the rules and understanding why the rules were put in place. Because there usually was some smart people, probably even smarter than you, who thought about it and wrote these rules as best they could, or designed a process as best they could, knowing all that they knew then. And so to immediately say we should all blow this up and go around them that usually is that works exactly once. And then a new set of rules kind of clamp down and et cetera. So when we're talking about hacking, we're talking about understanding the systems, the rules, the processes, and most importantly, the people. But oftentimes there's more ways than one to do things. So it is, what is the clever fix? And in back to Enrique's example, you know, he was able to use NGA networks rather than Air Force networks when he first deployed a tanker refueling app for the Combined Air Operations Center out in Qatar. And so finding ways to do things in an authorized way, but that may be clever or simplified or proof of concept that show rather than tell, that's really powerful, because there's a lot of and we're big fans of telling, right? We're big fans of you know, how do you write a really good one pager? Something that Tom Khalil and others used to make us do is, you know, how do you put this on a single sheet of paper and make that shareable and usable? Because, you know, in any organization, but especially government bureaucracies, there's kind of this socialization piece where lots of people have to be read in on, I don't mean from a security standpoint, but on the idea of whether they're going to fund it, whether they're going to accredit it, you know, who's got the requirement. And like, and so, you know, the written word and how you do a one pager and how you build momentum is important that way. But, you know, the shortcut, the hack that we're talking about here is can you show what you're talking about? And can you do that with enough permissions? So you may not have permission to do this globally, but maybe you have permission to do it locally, or in a particular unit or a particular way. And then you can show people what you're talking about. And when you can show some people something, you know, you can get a lot more enthusiasm, and that can attract people, it can attract resources, it can attract a desire to try and fix the system. And so this is another reason why it's so helpful to go through the system as it exists. And Marina talks a lot about this at the VA, is it took her 2 years to hire somebody. So it's kind of crazy. Think about the CTO of an agency, direct report to the secretary, who's told to go fix the VA. And yet it takes her 2 years to hire her first technologist. And, you know, everyone told her, well, you should use this waiver or this, you know, break the rules this way or break the rules that way. But by actually understanding what the process was and where it was broken, and her ability to communicate that non-judgmentally, but just, you know, the facts of how long things were taking and why they were breaking down. And, you know, she went and, you know, had world-class technologists apply and get rejected because they didn't meet the particular formatting, you know, requirement of the federal resume and what have you. She was able to show to the VA just where the system was broken and help them fix it. So that by the time she left, and then now with the current CTO of the VA, Charles Worthington, you know, there's an office of the CTO that has a lot of high performing designers and technologists and security professionals, because they really took the time to understand the process and reform the process. And you'll find unexpected allies, not just in your functional area, but you'll find them all across your organization and in other organizations. And that's really what we're talking about, is how do you band together with them to get them excited, not only about your particular project, it could be an acquisition, it could be a particular technology thing, it could be reforming an HR process, but get them also excited about some systemic change. And too often we start from the, with full love and respect to someone who used to write laws from Congress, you know, too often we start from like, hey, let's try and fix the thing systemically. If you actually are starting a more of a bottoms up approach, you have much more powerful stories and data about where it's broken, why it's broken, and what has to be fixed. And I think if you marry that with top down desire to reform, whether it's legislative or administrative from the top, I think that's the real powerful kind of codification and acceleration of change.
That's great. Now, one of your chapters, I think, focuses on a really interesting challenge that faces a lot of bureaucracies, but particularly, I would say, military, civilian parts of the Pentagon, defense industry. That's leadership change. And people sometimes grumble. I mean, maybe they're sometimes happy when a leader leaves, but more often it's that there's maybe too much leadership change in these things to keep momentum going on good processes or good ideas. You talk about how to focus on leadership change and use it to your advantages. So, you know, what give some advice, you know, how that happens all the time, both in defense industry and in the Pentagon. How should people be thinking about leadership change more as an opportunity than a challenge?
Yeah, and look, nothing is forever. people turn over all the time in small and large organizations and in the Pentagon, in the military services. And, you know, there's different rates of change, right? You can say that there's more predictable ones in uniform, and maybe the civilians kind of don't turn over as fast. But this is true in corporate America too. It's true in startups and scale-ups. There's just different cadences to that turnover. And the point that we're trying to make in the book is that if you're frustrated, there may be opportunities with a leadership change, which may not be anticipated, right? There could be a scandal and your boss is out, or, you know, there could be a reason for a leadership change that's, you know, you're not anticipating. But if you are better prepared to kind of brief the incoming folks and give them ideas on how they can have a quick win. And so, you know, if you really have, and this is true also in a crisis too, like in a crisis, people are desperately grasping for what is the thing that's going to get them out of the crisis and give them some momentum back, right? And so in either case, whether it's a leadership change or in a crisis, if you have something that can be helpful, and so it needs to be articulated simply and cleanly and not overpromised. But in those cases, you may be able to get people excited about your particular project, and they may provide additional resources, additional proof points, additional people, additional authorities or waivers or what have you. And so we're big fans of being prepared because you never know when those leadership changes are gonna happen. And I think that's true for folks who are working to support the DoD mission and business partners with the Defense Department. Is there's going to be that rate of change, and you know, betting on a single technical champion or a single commander or something like that is a point of failure. Is you want to have a number of champions and people who feel that your solution and technology is ultimately something that they absolutely need to accomplish mission.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I've always found that as new leaders come in, whether it's legislative branch, executive branch, or industry, they come wanting to accomplish things. And that is a moment where their teams can take advantage of that energy and enthusiasm and accomplish things. And like you're saying, you just have to empower them, help them do what they want to do.
There's such an information asymmetry when new leaders come into an organization, right? And there's I don't call it a trust deficit, but there's this question of like, they may not have a lot of longstanding authentic relationships. It depends. Some people who may have worked in the organization prior, and the Pentagon, of course, has this, where people who will come in having served in leadership positions or in more junior positions prior, right? But oftentimes there's this question of, well, I don't know all the details of what's gone on in the organization, and I'm not quite sure who to trust or who's got what agenda. And so if you can find ways to, maybe it's not the principal, maybe it's someone who's part of that staff who right, because people oftentimes bring staff with them. This is true in public and private too, but maybe you can get to them and just say, hey, you know, here's a way that we can help accomplish whatever that leader's priorities are. Some people spend 30, 60, 90 days doing a listening tour and then establish a set of priorities, commander's intent, what have you. Other people are pretty clear from the beginning what their priorities were going to be. And in fact, one of the things that Marina did at the very end of her tenure at the VA was work with the incoming administration to make sure that they saw the Office of the CTO, and for that matter, the entire U.S. Digital Service and Presidential Innovation Fellows and a number of initiatives that we had worked on together as something that was business friendly. That, you know, fundamentally, you're framing things more in terms of efficiency rather than civic tech, right? So I think there's kind of a different frame on some of those things. But it's listening closely to what the incoming administration wanted to do. And so they very much wanted to bring a business focus and an efficiency focus to the VA. And there's a strong argument that having the kind of modern customer-centered design practices, having modern cloud-based software, having technologists inside the VA could really help accelerate some of that modernization that they were looking to bring. And so just understanding and listening for that, and then being able to frame your particular initiative in the context of a new leader. We're not saying make stuff up or skate outside the lines or misstate anything, but there's different ways to sell things. And that's ultimately what we're talking about is, most executives and most entrepreneurs are selling something at heart. That is, they're selling an initiative, a project, a product, something like that. And that's great. Like, we shouldn't shy away from, we sometimes have like a negative feeling towards the word sales, but I think some of the best policy and private sector entrepreneurs that I know were selling a particular thing, right? I think that's great. And if you're going to sell it, it's all about having that simple story, having people get excited. If you can, being able to show results, and having people trust you and building authentic relationships where, as much as possible, you're able to help them as well as you're getting their buy-in.
As I think some people might say, well, this is national security. It's serious business, right? And so we have to go slower in certain things. We have to have processes to make sure we are secure and reliable, that we are on the right side of ethics rules, that we are good stewards of taxpayer dollars. Why? Because there's so many trolls under so many bridges. There's the GAO and the IGs and the test community and those congressional staffers, right? They're all looking for someone to make a misstep. And so the bureaucracy kind of can protect you from those kinds of things. The processes can protect you from those kinds of things. You actually touch on this in the book, I think, in an interesting way when you talk about red teams and problem lists, and almost like when we've thought about acquisition reform in the past, we've always talked about this idea of reforming the oversight processes. So how do we do oversight over the overseers in the process to try to speed the process a little bit? So talk a little bit about that part of it, the tendency to push the easy button and go for the problem list or go red team everything to death.
Yeah, I think it's easy to point out all the problems or all the flaws. And that's actually not very constructive to making change, right? Because I mean, put yourself, you've served in government. So put yourself in a situation where someone comes to you with, here's a list of 50 problems, of 50 issues, 50 vulnerabilities, 50 anything. And you just kind of look at them and you're like, okay, well, what do you want me to do with that, right? And then someone in your next meeting is going to bring you the next 50 things, And so that is, if you break it down and you put yourself in the shoes of someone who is mission-oriented and wants to make important reforms responsibly to get it done, like coming to them with a list of 50 things is just not very productive. So we just don't think that's a useful way. You can have that in the back of your mind, but ultimately, once you identify problems, you should be down selecting to a single problem that you want to help solve, and here is a potential solution or a way to approach. People are much more receptive to that. To your point about oversight, I couldn't agree more. In terms of, we have a community of oversight and oversight over the oversight and so forth, and like, that's great, and it's been put there for a reason. On the other hand, it's contributing to why we tend to fail at really large things really slowly. And that's true whether you're talking about new weapons platforms or whether you're talking about the FBI case management system, right? $1 billion system that didn't work. Is we tend to put requirements on things, right? We tend to gather requirements for years. We tend to procure for years. We tend to build for years. And then we end up with, a thing that can't cross a bridge because it's 70 or 80 tons. Right. And, you know, that I'm not saying that M1s aren't particularly useful. Like I don't want all the tankers mad at me, but I'm just saying that that whether you're talking about an IT system or whether you're talking about a weapon system, that's just not a productive way to move forward. I mean, maybe that's productive for aircraft carriers. And I know we're building a few now, but like other than aircraft carriers, that level of like, hey, let's requirements for years, you know, procure for years, build for years, and then out comes something that we're going to actually test. You know, that's a way to failure, and a failure at such massive scale. And you only look at the conflict in Ukraine, where you can see them rapidly operationally experimenting with technology to say, you know, there is a better way. And can we find ways to more quickly operationalize and test what works, and then what works scale back in the Defense Department. And I just had the privilege of spending 10 days in the CENTCOM area. So General Carrillo invited a few of us to do an innovation tour. And, you know, we had a chance to spend time with like Task Force 52, 59, 99, and saw, you know, operational experimentation of commercial technology at the edge. And it was just fascinating to see that compared to the, hey, let me, you know, write requirements for years and kind of contemplate the problem. And we're very good at admiring the problem. And, you know, human beings are also very good at adding rather than subtracting. So whenever there's a scandal or a problem, we'll add another layer of oversight. And that's how you kind of get these layers of oversight and test. And so I said, well, wait a second, this is national security. And my argument would be like, well, wait a second, this is national security. We have to go faster. Like our ability to deter conflict in strategic competition is based upon our ability to go faster.
Yeah, our current CEO is former Deputy Secretary David Norquist. He often says, biggest challenge is China. We're not going to out-central plan China. There's got to be a different approach if we're going to win this technological competition race, right? And I think that's what you're pointing to also, right? That it's American innovation that got us this far, and innovating within our processes in a safe and responsible way is, I think, a good way, you know, to approach this idea.
I would go further and build on that and say that we can innovate our processes. So we want to find ways to bring innovation in it. And by that, you know, I'm talking about entrepreneurs who are building great technology, commercial technology that they can bring into the Defense Department. But we also have to find ways to innovate our processes and say, wait a second, you know, ultimately the goal is to be secure. You know, compliance is different than security. And can we find a ways to prove that we're secure in 1/10th or 1/100th of the time, right? And can we think about failure in terms of resiliency, right? And can we think about, you know, how do we do true chaos monkey engineering rather than, hey, we're going to have this one exercise and we're going to pretend that all these things fail, right? And so there's this element of innovation inside the bureaucracy. And a lot of the book is fundamentally about that, is whether you're talking about hiring or budgeting or procurement or new technology, a lot of which is software based, you know, how do you find ways to improve the system? And that ultimately comes from people who have spent time inside the system or are currently inside an organization and banding together in sometimes uncreative and creative ways to find a solution and then scale it.
We're running out of time. I could talk to you about this stuff all day. I feel like I've talked to you about this stuff for over a decade. Wait, I actually have talked to you about this stuff for over a decade. I'm curious on this China question. Hey, have you done any thinking about China? China is classically a bureaucracy. Are they getting better at hacking their own bureaucracy? Is that something that we should be worried about?
I think it is something we should be worried about. It's something we should be studying. They have a level of military economic fusion that is very different from ours. And, you know, I don't think they have the authority to operate kind of process, right? So, you know, we have set out some very kind of heavyweight processes that I don't see the corollary I realized, you know, that the Chinese government is quite the bureaucracy. But, you know, maybe circling back is, you know, bureaucracies need to actually have a mission. And so if you say, well, what's more important for them? They wanted to build more ships and do more things. And you know, bureaucracies can be learning environments. So maybe they had an ATO process, you know, the authority to operate process of essentially accrediting something on a network. And so maybe they had one of those and they decided to revise it or change it because they were trying to achieve a goal. And ultimately, you know, when you start worshiping the processes so much that you're failing at your goals, I think that's the risk that we fall under. And so, you know, how can we focus on the outcomes and find ways, you know, by understanding the processes? I'm not saying don't use them, but how can we find ways to reform them, improve them, simplify them, modernize them? You know, something like that will actually get us so that we're able to compete strategically.
I'm going to close with the last question, thinking about the NDIA membership, those big companies, small companies, universities, government employees, all of whom, you know, are part of NDIA, thinking about these kinds of questions. What would you say are one or two major takeaways from the book that they should sort of think about as they try to operate in the defense enterprise?
Yeah, I think that all of your listeners and members, they can be innovators too. Not everybody wants to be the primary entrepreneur. Sometimes people want to be the enabler, the supporter, the catalyst, the unblocker, the amplifier. But everyone's got a role to play or can play a role. And I'm hopeful that many of your members are going to make those changes, both small and then ultimately that are going to turn into large changes for the betterment of our national security.
That's great. I want to thank you, Nick, for joining us today. The book, again, I'm going to hold it up, Hack Your Bureaucracy. It's available anywhere books are sold. There's Nick with his version. Do you have that other one that you were showing? That one was awesome, too.
Yes, I have the Italian version, which you can see a very stylish woman in a business suit. I don't speak Italian, but our publisher negotiated this, so.
Let me know when there's a Mandarin version. I'd be curious when that one comes out. With that, I'm going to close. I just want to let everybody know that the Emerging Technologies Institute is continuing its broad range of activities. To check out our website for our various reports, webinars, events that are coming up. All can be found on our website, ndia.org or www.emergingtechnologiesinstitute.org. Thanks again, Nick, and thanks everyone for tuning into this week's episode of Emerging Technology Horizons. If you enjoyed this podcast, don't forget to hit the like button and subscribe to our channel to stay up to date with all of our latest content. Thanks very much.